Unless the rulers are well informed, they cannot serve their people well. Queen Juliana has the welfare of her people at heart. Therefore, she has an open mind that permits her to look at all facets of life, not bowing to the dictates of the few, and so she was not persuaded to cancel the appointment. At this time I will relate the true facts of my interview with the Queen. They have never been published before. The press reports quoting alleged questions and answers from the interview were falsified, as no reporters were allowed inside the palace during the interview. I left London and arrived in Amsterdam on the 15th of May, 1959. Miss Ray D'Aquila and some newspaper reporters were at the airport to meet me. I was still suffering from the cold I had caught in Scotland, so I excused myself and was taken to a small hotel on the outskirts of Amsterdam. The next afternoon I was called to a television rehearsal for a program that was to be given that evening. This was on May 16, and I showed my film on the program. The reception by the public of my subject and the film was very good. After the rehearsal, we drove back to the hotel, picked up my luggage and left for The Hague. Miss D'Aquila had arranged transportation by automobile, and I arrived at The Hague about midnight. My hotel was in a quiet residential district, across the street from a beautiful park. The first day was set aside for me to rest. That morning I unpacked my camera and walked through the park to the ocean. Several restful hours were spent strolling around and photographing the local scenery. I had been placed in this secluded hotel purposely to avoid the press. When newsmen could not locate me, they became very irritated. Those in charge of publicity would not say where I was staying, and the manager of the hotel had been given orders not to reveal my presence. For one day and evening I was able to relax. On the morning of May 18, I had breakfast and readied myself for the visit to Soestdijk Palace near Utrecht. The palace car was to call for me at 10:30 a.m. This was an informal meeting, so my business suit was proper attire. I had been carefully coached on the proper etiquette and conduct in the presence of my royal hosts. When the car arrived, I was introduced to the chauffeur who held the door open as I entered. To evade the press, we avoided the customary highway to the palace. We entered the palace garden through a gate opened by a guard who saluted smartly as we passed. I noticed the highway in front of the palace was empty as we turned into the grounds. A winding driveway, bordered by massive shrubs, brought us to the huge entrance. My mind was so taken up in trying to remember all the instructions I had been given that I failed to notice much about the palace itself, except that it was white. The chauffeur had spoken very few words as we rode along and had given me a mint to relieve my throat when I coughed. It was 11 a.m. when the car stopped in front of the entrance. A uniformed attendant opened the door, saluted, and escorted me up the broad steps to the palace doors, which were opened by two doormen dressed in royal blue, who also saluted. When I entered, one of these men helped me out of my top coat and muffler. The other escorted me into a large library with a high ceiling. I had been nervous with anticipation, but a feeling of calm and ease came over me as I stood in the presence of the Queen. She and the others present were standing when I entered the room. The Queen's secretary came forward and introduced me to Her Majesty, Queen Juliana. In turn, I was presented to Prince Bernhard, Lieutenant General Schaper, Chief of the Royal Netherlands Air Staff, Professor John Bloed, of aerial medicine, Dr. M. Rue, telecommunications, and Mr. Kolff, president of the Royal Netherlands Society for Aviation. When the Queen acknowledged the introduction, I completely forgot all the instructions and could not remember the formalities that should have been followed. Instead, I acted upon my feelings and was at ease, for here was a feeling of welcome as among friends. The Queen graciously asked if I drank coffee. When I replied that I did, coffee was served in large cups of beautiful design, while we remained standing. After all had been served, we were asked to be seated. That coffee was the best I had had since leaving America. We were at one end of the library, seated in lounge chairs assembled in a horseshoe position. Directly across from me sat the Queen. Next to her was the Prince, and on my right, next to the Prince, was a gentleman who acted as spokesman for him. As I remember, this gentleman was Mr. Kolff. Seated on my left were the other three gentlemen already named. The secretary was seated a little apart from the others. Small pastries were served, and as we sat enjoying the refreshments and indulging in informal conversation, I noted that Her Majesty wore a light blue frock. The men were dressed in black suits with white shirts and black ties. Cigarettes were passed. Then the secretary opened the topic for which I had been summoned. She referred to my two books and asked a question regarding my trip around the moon. I was aware of having been granted only 45 minutes, so I made my answers as brief as possible. The astronomer and Air Force chief asked questions next, trying to discredit the interplanetary visitors. As I think of it now, perhaps my answer was a little rude in the presence of royalty, for I said, "I have known of no major officials of our Air Force, and few astronomers, who have told what they actually know about the visitors from space. It is a known fact that the secret files and confidential reports of the Air Force have never been released to the public, or even to high officers in the government. I am inclined to believe this applies to all governments." I think Her Majesty knew exactly what I meant, for she gave a tiny smile of acknowledgement. I pointed out that most of the findings of our Earth satellite had been published in my books at least 3 years before. Many questions were asked about inhabitants of other planets. I retold much of what I had written in my second book. The major questions of our conference dealt with our future in outer space. Awareness of time was lost as we all grew interested in the conversation about outer space. What began as a 45-minute interview lasted 2 hours. Finally, the Queen reminded me that my lecture started in less than an hour. Interest was so great in the topic that, if it had not been for the lecture, we could have kept talking for hours. When the Queen reminded me of the time, I arose and we all shook hands in a very friendly manner. I was deeply impressed with the firm, sincere grasp of Her Majesty and the Prince. The spokesman for the Prince escorted me to the car. During the conference, he had stated he would like to take a trip with the space people, and he repeated the request as we descended the steps to the waiting car. As we were leaving the palace grounds, I noticed a large group of people standing across the highway and facing the palace. As the car came through the gate, many of these people gave the familiar salute. Possibly they only wanted to get a look at the common man who had been granted a private interview with the Queen, and whom the press had described as an objectionable visitor. On the fast trip back to the hotel, I noticed crowds of people along the highway, saluting as we passed. Arriving at the hotel, we found a car waiting to take me to the lecture at The Hague. The Queen's chauffeur asked if he might attend the lecture and was granted permission to do so. Due to the long interview at the palace, I arrived 20 minutes late at the lecture hall where a capacity crowd was waiting. The people present were filled with curiosity and anticipation in regard to my meeting with Queen Juliana. Reporters especially were insistent that I give them all the details. This I could not do, for the meeting had been on a level of dignity that denied me the privilege of speaking until the Queen spoke first. All I could say was, "The Queen was very kind, and if there were more people like her, the world would be a better place to live in." A tremendous burst of applause took place, and from there on the lecture proceeded as normal. After the lecture, the reporters crowded around me asking, "What did thy Queen say?" "It is the Queen's honor to speak first," I replied. This made the press very dissatisfied with me. Some went so far as to write up a fictitious interview, complete with questions and answers. When I returned to my hotel, I was grateful that no one knew where I was, for now I could relax and go over the events of the day. A radio was in my room, and the next morning I tuned it to the BBC since I could not understand the Dutch of local stations. On an early morning program called The News of Europe, I was very much surprised to hear a report from a Russian scientist stating that the moon was not composed of volcanic dust, but rather of granite formations similar to Earth. Many green spots that looked like vegetation had been observed on the other side of the moon. This confirmed some of the things I had told the Queen during our two-hour conference. I was curious to know just how the Russians had gained this information. My friends and I discussed the possibilities later that morning. Was it possible that a Russian had made a trip as I had, or did they receive the information from their moonshot that went into orbit around the sun? Information received at the time of this writing seems to confirm that they did. Before the morning was over, I was asked if I would accept an interview with Fox Movie Tone in downtown Hague. I would be called for and taken to the appointed place, so I agreed. The selected place was a large hotel in the center of town. Our car was parked across the street from the building. I was told to walk across the street and enter the hotel. Cameras were ready and set for operation, but I had to rehearse the walk several times before pictures were finally taken. In the final take, the large glass doors, framed in brass, opened automatically and I entered the hotel. I was greeted by many people, including the manager of the hotel, and received the customary salute. This was not photographed. I was taken to a large room where cameras and sound equipment were in place. Here I was seated beside a small mahogany table which held a bouquet of American Beauty roses. My interrogator was seated on my right. His first question was, "The world wants to know what the Queen had to say." My answer was that Her Majesty and His Royal Highness were deeply interested in the future of outer space developments. The interrogator was very dissatisfied with my reply and tried to get me to relate our conversation in some detail. When I refused, he hurried through the other questions, and the news conference was over. I was told this newsreel would be shown all over the world, but I have no reports of it ever having been shown. It is interesting to note that, after my visit to the palace, wherever I went in Holland I received the salute from those who recognized me. Perhaps this is a customary honor paid to one who has been received by the Queen. On Friday, May 22, I received an invitation from the manager of the City Theatre in downtown Amsterdam, to attend the preview of an Italian film, Death Comes from Outer Space. The death that came from outer space was a gigantic asteroid traveling at terrific speed directly toward the Earth. This asteroid was formed from all the debris blown into space by our atomic and hydrogen bomb explosions. The people of Earth were in a panic, for they were warned that at any moment it could hit our planet and cause complete destruction. Meanwhile, huge tidal waves and heavy earthquakes were wreaking havoc in many places throughout the world. The scientists of all nations called upon the military in every other nation to aim their atomic missiles at the asteroid and to fire simultaneously. In this way, the asteroid was destroyed by the same weapons that had caused its creation. Representatives of the press were present at the showing. After it was over, I was asked if such things could happen in real life. I replied that it could and gave the following explanation. The lightning bolt is created from invisible particles of matter that are fused together by the terrific heat of a natural electrical discharge. It is entirely possible for the millions of tons of debris that have been blown into the upper regions of the Earth's atmosphere to come together and form an artificial asteroid. The larger the mass of debris, the more attraction it would have for additional particles. This picture alerted me to the possibility that radiation and fallout are not the only dangers we might be facing from our atomic explosions. Reports have come from Mexico stating that a huge fireball crashed into a mountain just before the disastrous earthquake there in August of 1959. Recently, several planes brave reportedly hit objects from space. Some have survived, others have crashed to their doom. Could they have crashed into some of the high-energy pockets left by our explosions? Some of these man-made asteroids burn and glow, and could be mistaken for ordinary meteorites. This may also be the answer to some of the fireballs that have been reported. By way of closing this chapter, I would like to reproduce in part a letter concerning the lecture in Amsterdam, sent to co-workers in the Netherlands area. It was written by Miss Ray D'Aquila, dated June 13, 1959, and reads as follows. At the end of the lecture in Amsterdam, Professor E. L. Seeliger of Bergen, an H. physicist and former Delft professor, stepped on the platform and thanked our friend Adamski in public for the things that he had brought us. Quoting him exactly, "The things that we have heard may sound strange to most of us, if not to all. But strange things happen every day, if our eyes are open. I hope that we will be open-minded and benefit from the things we have heard today." The audience applauded heartily. Inside information. Professor Seeliger is in good relation to the Queen, and if we take his mental courage and her interest and deep understanding, we may conclude that after all George Adamski's visit to our country has been a successful one and the stepping stone to a better future. Regarding my interview with the Queen, I will again quote from the report, but one thing we can say for sure, no press reporters were present. So what the press had further to say about his audience was a big lie from the first to the last line. Paris Match, for instance, carried a wholly imaginative interview with the Queen, complete with questions and answers. I wish those imaginative reporters could have been present during my interview with Queen Juliana. They might have learned something of dignity, kindness and gentility, from a great woman who rules her country with wisdom and love. 5. The Zurich incident. My train arrived in Basel, Switzerland from Holland on Saturday evening, May 23. Mrs. Luzinstag, a Swiss researcher, and some of her friends met me at the station. These fine friendly people introduced themselves. Then we proceeded to a lovely hotel on the Rhine River. Centrally located, this hotel afforded a beautiful view of the river and surrounding country. The next day, Sunday, I had a restful visit at the home of Mrs. Zinstag. Monday morning we held a special preview of the film for the Basel police and local press. Tuesday we drove to a small hotel on the outskirts of Zurich. The critical accounts published in Holland were being reprinted by the Swiss press, and my friends desired to protect me as much as possible. I appreciated their thoughtfulness, for I was tired and feeling below par. Swiss reporters bombarded me with the same questions that had been asked in Holland. My answers likewise were the same. It was the Queen's honor to speak first. My first lecture in Zurich, May 26, was most successful. Unfortunately, many people had to be turned away because of lack of seating capacity. When the lecture was over and May had left the hall, a small group of about 25 persons remained to ask questions. One man accused Mrs. Zinstag of submitting a special list of questions instead of the ones asked by the audience. He also accused me of impersonating the real George Adamski. We later learned the man had been placed in the audience to start trouble, but apparently he lost his nerve in front of so many people. This was our first warning of organized resistance, but despite this incident we proceeded to the second lecture in Zurich. The chief of police in Zurich called and asked for a private showing of my film. This seemed a strange request as I had already shown the film at the first lecture. However, I agreed to meet with him at the appointed time. As before, I requested a written permit to lecture and show the film. I already had the permits for Zurich, and I wondered why the private showing had been requested. I believe the real reason was that the indisputable evidence in the film was beginning to disturb the silence group. The meeting with the chief of police was pleasant. At the conclusion of the film he remarked that it was very surprising and that he had enjoyed seeing it. I think he was amazed to see that the film showed a large metallic spaceship, and not just vague lights in the sky. While we were driving him from the showing to his office, he chatted about traffic problems in his city, and inquired about similar problems in California. As he left the car, he said he would be at the next lecture with some of his officers, adding the comment that this is customary at all public gatherings. On the morning of the second Zurich lecture, Mrs. Zinstag and I had a very pleasant interview with two reporters of the German weekly news magazine Der Spiegel. The reporters asked many questions in perfect English. Despite all of the previous skeptical publicity, Der Spiegel published a long extract of our interview, correctly translated. They did leave out some rather important links, and thus imparted an ever so slight leg-pulling slant to it. The interview had lasted more than 2 hours though, and it would have been impossible to print all that had been said. Considering everything, the magazine displayed a high amount of courage and independence. The Zurich police attended the next lecture, on the evening of May 29. The puzzling thing was, they were all in civilian clothes instead of in uniform. According to a report later published by Mrs. Zinstag, 300 students were seated strategically among 700 listeners. The reception of George Adamski by this majority was very warm and friendly. The start was good, but from the first, The students carried through their disturbance plan in a carefully studied crescendo. First clapping, stamping after every sentence, then hollering, singing. After some time a nice man from the public asked for peace, but to no avail. The storm grew worse and worse. They started throwing things around, first into the public, then at us on the platform. Already before 9 o'clock the organizers had called for the police, but no police showed up. Only when another listener came up and asked after the police, a plainclothes man came up slowly and said, "Oh, we have been here for some time." He then spoke in a rather weak voice and with still weaker arguments to the students and to the public. Some people had started fighting with the students. His speech failed, of course. In the general uproar, one was not even aware that he was from the police. Only those seated next to the platform had grasped the fact. How could anyone expect plainclothes men to restore order in such a tohuwabohu, sick? There was something very fishy about those uniformless policemen. The students now started throwing fruit around. We decided to go on and show the film. Before the hall was dark and I explained its content in the way I had learned, and it was comparatively quiet in the hall until it got dark. Then the culmination point came. The rowdies used children's trumpets and other noisy instruments and also fireworks and firecrackers. How well everything had been prepared. This shows from the fact that from the very beginning they shot powerful searchlights on the screen so that the pictures were barely visible. These strong lights were no ordinary torches, but must have been attached to the electrical wiring system of the hall. After we had gotten halfway through the film, a beer bottle was thrown from the gallery toward the platform, hitting a lady on the shoulder. Some people cried out, and then the police ordered lights at once. This was the end of the show. The most important paper of Switzerland, the Neue Zeitung, wrote a completely false report the next day, stating that the one thing which had functioned on this evening had been the Zurich police. Since we made a tape, we are in possession of the policeman's speech. We can easily disprove this statement in a future publication. Needless to say that the big majority of the newspapers followed the story of their big brother, the most important financial and commercial paper in this country and the whole German-speaking part of Europe. I was taken from the hall via the back door, through several buildings, to a small cafe on another street. Several students followed. One young chap who spoke English was admitted to the cafe. He acted as the spokesman for the rest of the group. "I'm here to offer an apology to you," he began. "There were a few of us who tried to listen to what you said. We heard the nice things you said about Dr. Zicky, the scientist. We had been told you would try to discredit Dr. Zicky and modern astronomy." This was a demonstration in protest and in defense of both. The next day reports started coming to us. We were told that the men of Diogenes's Technische Hochschule University were the organizers of the disturbance at my lecture. However, they had no doubt received their instructions from higher up. As I reviewed the events of the night before, the picture became increasingly clear. The private viewing of my film by the police chief, the lack of cooperation from the police at my lecture, and the powerful lights thrown on the screen to prevent the public from seeing the rest of my pictures, all added up to one thing. The overwhelming onslaught of truth apparently had the silence group greatly worried. They had tried to make a last stand, hoping to succeed where they had failed before. I realized then that the evidence most likely to cause them to go further in their efforts to stop me was my motion picture film of spacecraft. As I stated toward the beginning of this book, I had had my first trouble with the film in Sydney, Australia. I had also learned that some of the police were working with the silence group. Many newspapers had been given orders on what to print. Each time these papers carried an article about my lectures, they would also attack my films. During a lecture tour into the Pacific Northwest, USA, prior to my leaving on this world trip, one of the largest newspapers in Seattle, Washington, had stated to my colleague, C.A. Honey, that they had been given orders not to print complimentary material about UFOs. They tried to refuse taking a regular paid advertisement for my Seattle lecture. Mr. Honey finally talked the advertising department into taking it, after stating that it was a shame that newspapermen were not as bold and impartial today as they were in years gone by. In the days before we had a controlled press, fearless editors would have screamed to high heaven if someone had threatened them and forbidden them to print certain types of information. More than one newspaper editor has admitted having orders he dared not violate, in regard to publicizing the spacecraft and their occupants. In their attempt to discredit me, Die Swiss instigators revealed the lack of neutrality in their country. The good people of Switzerland suffered the embarrassment. An American physicist just happened to lecture in Basel the same night as my lecture in Zurich. He tipped his hand as to whom he was working for when he made the statement, according to the press, that he would answer any questions on flying saucers, provided the question was accompanied by 100 Swiss francs. The money was to be given to a charitable institution. Needless to say, no questions were asked. When I returned to Basel, a reporter for one of the large papers of Zurich asked if I would accept an apology for what had happened. I had been told previously that the police and the organizers of the demonstration were in trouble, and had been severely criticized by one of the papers. My own feeling was that this reporter had been sent by the officials of Zurich to try and modify the repercussions of what had taken place. My reply to him was the same that I had given to the students. The apology should be given to the Swiss people and not to me, for the incident had placed them in a bad light all over the world. The rapid pace of my lecture tour soon began to have its effect on me. Mrs. Zinstag became concerned with my extreme fatigue and persistent cough, and insisted that I see a doctor. A complete physical examination showed a congestion of the lungs. The doctor ordered me to stop the tour, suggesting that, if I did not, I might go home in a wooden box. He was afraid that pneumonia would develop. As a result of his warning, I cancelled the remainder of my European tour, aside from a short visit to Rome. Telegrams were sent to all the co-workers in the countries I couldn't visit, inviting them to come to Basel and receive a tape recording for each of their countries. A public lecture in Basel was cancelled, as was also the one in Locarno. But it was agreed that I would give a private talk to the group leaders in the two cities. The following is a report given by Mrs. Zinstag. While George Adamski stayed another week in Basel, Mr. and Mrs. Karl Elveit, chairman of the German UFO study group, arrived with another staunch supporter, Mrs. M. Muller. They had started a very big organization and advertising campaign in Germany and were desperate when they learned everything had been cancelled. They felt better again when George Adamski generously offered them the right to copy the film so that at least some of the scheduled meetings could be held, though minus George Adamski in person. Dora Bauer, liaison worker from Austria, and George Neidart, Munich organizer, arrived at their earliest convenience. As a compensation, they also got the right to show a copy of the film, as did liaison man Dr. Alberto Perigo, of Italy, and H. Peterson of Denmark. It cannot be denied that there was another point too, on which G.A. George Adamski had his misgivings. UFO study and discussion activities all over the German-speaking part of Europe are very much permeated with esoteric, occult and sectarian concepts. Thus, in these parts George Adamski would not only have had to fight the disbelieving of the so-called realists, he would also have had to expose himself to the dissent, or even the protests coming from these various factions. Or else, from all appearances, to have accepted the promotion and misplaced protection by innumerable societies, cults, associations, etc. This ended my European lectures, and I looked forward to a few days' rest at Locarno, Switzerland. Basel is located in the northwestern part of Switzerland. To reach Locarno from Basel, I traveled by rail through Zurich, past beautiful lakes and magnificent mountains. The train then rolled onto the southeastern part of Switzerland. Locarno, in the canton, state, of Ticino, is beautiful beyond description. It is nestled on the slopes of the southern Alps, on Lake Maggiore, near the Italian border. Lovely homes are tucked in among trees and shrubs covering the hills completely around the lake. In the lakeside gardens are palm trees such as we have in California. The higher mountains in back of the town were snow-covered. with the subtropical trees and flowers in the foreground, it made a beautiful sight. It was the end of May when I passed through the mountains, and the lovely meadows were aflame with many different species of wild flowers. I was told that many of the rare varieties were protected by law. Americans I met who live there love the clean, beautiful country.